Chapter 7. On the Road Again. I don't remember how I got home after the interview or how I filled the hours in the wake of yet another professional debacle, but after still another sleepless night, it had now been over a week since I'd slept fully, I headed to the office. It was a gorgeous early March morning. The sun was out and the temperature was a crisp 30 degrees. I had walked through Times Square twice a day for 6 months, but today, once I hit the rows of billboards at its center, I was accosted by its garish colors. I tried to look away, to shield myself from shockwaves of pigment, but I couldn't. The bright blue wedge of an Eclipse gum sign emitted electric swirls of aqua and made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. I could feel the colors vibrating in my toes. There seemed to be something exquisite about the rush. It was simultaneously enervating and thrilling. But the thrill lasted only a moment when, to my left, the moving scroll of "Welcomes You to Times Square" caught my attention and made me want to retch in the middle of the street. M&Ms on an animated billboard to my left pirouetted before me, forging a massive migraine in my temples. Helpless in the face of this onslaught, I covered my eyes with mittenless hands, stumbling up 48th Street as if I had just gotten off a death-defying roller coaster, until I hit the newsroom, where the lights still felt bright but less aggressive.
"Angela, I have to tell you something strange,"
I whispered, concerned that people might be listening in, thinking I was crazy.
"I see bright colors. The colors hurt my eyes."
"What do you mean?" she asked, worry evident in her smile. Every day my behavior had been growing increasingly erratic, but it wasn't until this morning that my ramblings had begun to frighten her.
"Times Square, the colors, the billboards, they're so bright, brighter than I've ever seen them before."
"You must be really hungover," she laughed nervously.
"I didn't drink. I think I'm losing my mind." "If you're really concerned, I think you should go back and see a doctor."
"There's something wrong with me. This is how a crazy person acts." Frustrated with my inability to communicate what was happening to me, I slammed my hands down on the keyboard. The computer glowed back at me, bright and angry. I looked at Angela to see if she saw this too, but she was busy with her email.
"I can't do this!"
I shouted.
"Susanna, Susanna, hey, what's going on?"
Angela asked, surprised by the outburst. I had never been histrionic, and now that everyone was staring at me, I felt humiliated and on display, and hot tears streamed down my face and onto my blouse.
"Why are you crying?"
I shrugged off the question, too embarrassed to go into details I didn't understand.
"Do you want to go out for a walk or something? Grab a coffee?"
"No, no. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm all fucked up. I'm crying for no reason,"
I sobbed. As the crying spell took over my whole body, I became prisoner to it. The more I told myself to stop, the more powerful the sensation became. What was causing these hysterics? I fixated on anything my mind could grasp, picking apart the minutiae of my life, anything that felt uncertain.
"I'm bad at my job. Stephen doesn't love me. I'm broke. I'm crazy. I'm stupid."
Many of my colleagues were now returning to the office, dressed in black from the reporter's funeral, which I had not attended because I was too consumed by my own problems. Was this the reason I was crying? I hardly knew the man. Was I crying for myself, over the possibility that I might be next? Another reporter, who sat directly across from Angela, turned around.
"Susanna, are you okay?"
I hated the attention. I shot her a derisive look, heavy with loathing.
"Stop it!"
The tears continued down my face, but I was surprised to realize that instantly I was no longer sad. I was fine. Not fine, happy. No, not happy, sublime, better than I had ever felt in my entire life. The tears kept coming, but now I was laughing. A pulse of warmth shot up my spine. I wanted to dance or sing, something, anything except sit here and wallow in imaginary misery. I ran to the bathroom to splash some water on my face. As the cold water flowed, the bathroom stalls suddenly looked alien to me. How was it that civilization had gotten so far, but we still defecated in such close proximity to one another?
I looked at the stalls, and hearing the flushing of toilets, I could not believe that I had ever used one before. When I got back to my desk, my emotions now relatively stable, I called Mackenzie, who had been so helpful with my snooping problem weeks ago, and asked her to meet me downstairs. I wanted her opinion on what had just happened to me. When I found her behind the News Corp building, I noticed that she too was wearing black and had just arrived from the reporter's funeral. I suddenly felt ashamed for being so self-obsessed. "I'm so sorry to bother you when you're suffering," I said. "I know it's really selfish of me to behave like this right now."
"Don't worry about it. What's going on?" she asked.
I just, do you ever not feel like yourself?"
She laughed. "I hardly ever feel like myself."
"But this is different. Something is really wrong. I'm seeing bright colors, crying uncontrollably. I can't control myself," I repeated, wiping away the remaining moisture from my swollen eyes.
"Do you think I'm having a nervous breakdown? Do you think I'm going nuts?"
"Look, Susanna, this isn't something you can do yourself. You really need to just go see a doctor. I think you should write down all your symptoms as if you were going to write up a story about it. Don't leave anything out. As you know, even the smallest details can turn out to be the most important."
It was genius. I nearly ran away from her to go upstairs and start writing. But when I got to my desk, I wrote only a horizontal line, above it the word insomnia, below it the word vision. Then I began doodling a smiley face, though I don't remember scrawling out the drawing or what prompted it. "People are desperate, they'll do anything," I'd written. Abruptly, I stopped writing and began to clear everything off my desk. All the water bottles, the half-empty coffee cups, and the old articles that I would never read again. I lugged armfuls of books that I'd been saving for reasons I could no longer remember to the floor's dumpster and discarded them all as if they were evidence that I was a hoarder who had been unraveling for months. I suddenly felt in control of every part of my life. That buoyant happiness had returned, but even then I recognized that it was a perilous happiness. I feared that if I didn't express it and appreciate it, the emotion would blaze and burn away as quickly as it came. When I got back to my desk, I slammed my hands down on top of it. "Everything is going to be great," I announced, ignoring Angela's astonishment. I sauntered over to Paul's desk, high on my brand new, wonderfully simple theory on life. "Let's go downstairs for a smoke." As we took the elevator, Paul said, "You look much better." "Thanks, Paul. I feel so much better. I feel like myself again, and I have so much to talk to you about."
We lit cigarettes.
"You know, it's finally dawned on me what is wrong. I want to do more stories. Better stories, bigger stories. Not the feature bullshit. The real stuff, the real hard-hitting investigations."
"Well, that's great," Paul said, but he also looked concerned. "Are you okay? You're talking a mile a minute."
"Sorry, I'm just so excited."
"I'm glad to hear you're excited, you know, because some people had told me that you've been upset at your desk and you've been so sick the past month."
"That's over. I've seriously figured it out."
"Hey, have you talked to your mom recently?" Paul asked.
"Yeah, a few days ago. Why?"
"Just curious."
Paul was busy building a mental picture, ready to relate to Angela what he felt were the beginning signs of a breakdown. He had once seen another reporter whom he cared about fall apart. She began wearing bright, inappropriate makeup and acting strange, and she was later diagnosed with schizophrenia. After 10 minutes of my ramblings, Paul headed back inside and called Angela.
"Someone needs to call her mom or someone. This just isn't right."
While Paul was upstairs talking to Angela, I stayed outside. If anyone looked at me then, they would have assumed that I was deep in thought or working out a story in my head, nothing out of the ordinary. But in fact, I was far away. The pendulum had swung again, and now I felt wobbly and heightsick, that same feeling I'd had at the top of the mountain in Vermont, except without the terror. I floated above the crowd of News Corp employees. I saw the top of my own head, so close that I could almost reach out and touch myself. I saw Liz, the Wiccan librarian, and felt myself re-enter my grounded body.
"Liz! Liz!" I shouted. "I need to talk to you."
She stopped.
"Oh, hey, Susanna. How's it going?"
There was no time for pleasantries.
"Liz, did you ever feel like you're here, but you're not here?"
Sure, all the time, she said. No, you don't understand. I can see myself from above, like I'm floating above myself looking down, I said, wringing my hands.
That's normal, she said.
No, like you're outside of yourself looking in.
Sure.
Like you're in your own world, like you're not in this world.
I know what you're saying. It's probably just residue from the astral travel you experienced during the reading we did yesterday. I think I may have taken you to another realm. I apologize for that. Just try to relax and embrace it.
Meanwhile, Angela, worried about my erratic behavior, got permission from Paul to take me to the bar at a nearby Marriott hotel for a drink and to tease some more information out of me about why I was acting so out of character. When I returned to the newsroom, Angela convinced me to gather my things and join her on a walk a few blocks north up Times Square to the hotel bar. We walked into the hotel's main entranceway through revolving doors and stood beside a group of tourists waiting to take the transparent elevators to the 8th floor bar, but the crowd bothered me. There were too many people around. I couldn't breathe.
"Can we please take the escalator?" I begged Angela.
"Of course."
The escalators, decorated on each side with dozens of glowing bulbs, only intensified my jitters. I tried to ignore the heart palpitations and the sweat forming on my brow. Angela stood a few steps above, looking concerned. I could feel the pressure of fear rise in my chest, and suddenly I was crying again. At the 3rd floor, I had to get off the escalator to compose myself because I was sobbing so hard. Angela put her arm on my shoulder. In total, I had to get off the escalator 3 times to steady myself from sobbing during that 8-floor trip. Finally, we reached the bar floor. The rugs, which looked as if they belonged in an avant-garde production of Lawrence of Arabia, swirled before me. The harder I stared, the more the abstract patterns merged. I tried to ignore it. The 100-plus seat bar, which looked down over Times Square, was almost completely empty, with only a few groups of businessmen dotting the chairs around the entranceway. When we walked in, I was still bawling, and one group looked up from their cocktails and gawked at me, which made me feel worse and more pathetic. The tears kept coming, though I had no clue why. We positioned ourselves in the center of the room at seats with high chairs, far away from the other patrons. I didn't know what I wanted, so Angela ordered a Sauvignon Blanc for me and an Anchor Steam for herself.
"So what's really going on?" she asked, taking a small sip of her amber-colored beer.
"So many things. The job, I'm terrible at it. Stephen, he doesn't love me. Everything is falling apart. Nothing makes sense," I said, holding the wine glass like a comforting habit, but not drinking.
"I understand. You're young. You have this stressful job and a new boyfriend. It's all up in the air. That's scary. But is it really enough to make you feel this upset?"
She was right. I had been thinking about all of that, but it was a struggle to make one detail fit well enough to solve the entire problem, like jamming together pieces from incongruent sets of puzzles.
"There's something else," I agreed, "but I don't know what it is."
When I got home at 7 that night, Stephen was already waiting for me. Instead of telling him I'd been out with Angela, I lied and told him I had been at work, convinced that I needed to hide my perplexing behavior from him, even though Angela had urged me to just tell him the truth. But I did warn him that I wasn't acting like myself and hadn't been sleeping well.
"Don't worry," he responded. "I'll open a bottle of wine. That will put you to sleep."
I felt guilty as I watched Stephen methodically stir the sauce for shrimp fra diavolo with a kitchen towel tucked in his pant loops. Stephen was a naturally skilled and inventive cook, but I couldn't enjoy the pampering tonight. Instead, I stood up and paced. My thoughts were running wild from guilt to love to repulsion and then back again. I couldn't keep them straight, so I moved my body to quiet my mind. Most of all, I didn't want him to see me in this state.
"You know, I haven't really slept in a while," I announced. In fact, I couldn't remember the last time I had slept. I had gone without real sleep for at least 3 days, and the insomnia had been plaguing me for weeks on and off.
"I might make it hard for you to sleep."
He looked up from the pasta and smiled.
"Don't worry. You'll sleep better with me around."
He handed me a plate of pasta and a healthy helping of Parmesan.
My stomach turned at the sight, and when I tasted the shrimp, I almost gagged. I pushed the pasta around on my plate as he devoured his. I watched him, trying to hide my disgust.
"What? You don't like it?"
he asked, hurt.
"No, it's not that. I'm just not hungry.
Great leftovers,"
I said cheerfully, while having to physically restrain myself from pacing around the apartment. I couldn't stay with one thought. My mind was flooded with different desires, but especially the urge to escape. Eventually, I relaxed enough to lie down on my couch bed with Stephen. He poured me a glass of wine, but I left it on the windowsill. Maybe I knew on some primal level that it would have been bad for my state of mind. Instead, I chain-smoked cigarettes, one after another, down to their nubs.
"You're a smoking fiend tonight," he said, putting his own cigarette out. "Maybe that's why you're not hungry."
"Yeah, I should stop," I said. "I feel like my heart is beating out of my chest." I handed Stephen the remote, and he flipped the channel to PBS. As his heavy breathing turned into all-out snores, Spain, On the Road Again, came on, the reality show that followed actress Gwyneth Paltrow, chef Mario Batali, and New York Times food critic Mark Bittman through Spain. God, not Gwyneth Paltrow, I thought, but was too lazy to change the channel. As Batali ate luscious eggs and meat, she toyed with a thin goat's milk yogurt, and when he offered her a bite of his dish, she demurred. "That's nice to have at 7 in the morning, she said sarcastically. You could just tell how disgusted she was by his belly. As I watched her nibble on her yogurt, my stomach turned. I thought about how little I had eaten in the past week.
"Hold on," he retorted. "I can't see you on that high horse of yours."
I laughed right before everything went hazy. Gwyneth Paltrow. Eggs and meat. Darkness. Chapter 8. Out-of-body experience. As Stephen later described that nightmarish scene, I had woken him up with a strange series of low moans resonating among the sounds from the TV. At first he thought I was grinding my teeth, but when the grinding noises became a high-pitched squeak, like sandpaper rubbed against metal, and then turned into deep, sling-blade-like grunts, he knew something was wrong. He thought maybe I was having trouble sleeping, but when he turned over to face me, I was sitting upright, my eyes wide open, dilated but unseeing.
"Hey, what's wrong?"
No response. When he suggested I try to relax, I turned to face him, staring past him like I was possessed. My arms suddenly whipped straight out in front of me, like a mummy, as my eyes rolled back and my body stiffened. I was gasping for air. My body continued to stiffen as I inhaled repeatedly, with no exhale. Blood and foam began to spurt out of my mouth through clenched teeth. Terrified, Stephen stifled a panicked cry, and for a second he stared, frozen, at my shaking body. Finally, he jumped into action. Though he'd never seen a seizure before, he knew what to do. He laid me down, moving my head to the side so that I wouldn't choke, and raced for his phone to dial 911. I would never regain any memories of this seizure or the ones to come. This moment, my first serious blackout, marked the line between sanity and insanity. Though I would have moments of lucidity over the coming weeks, I would never again be the same person. This was the start of the dark period of my illness, as I began an existence in purgatory between the real world and a cloudy, fictitious realm made up of hallucinations and paranoia. From this point on, I would increasingly be forced to rely on outside sources to piece together this lost time. As I later learned, this seizure was merely the most dramatic and recognizable of a series of seizures I'd been experiencing for days already. Everything that had been happening to me in recent weeks was part of a larger, fiercer battle taking place at the most basic level inside my brain. The healthy brain is a symphony of 100 billion neurons, the actions of each individual brain cell harmonizing into a whole that enables thoughts, movements, memories, or even just a sneeze. But it takes only one dissonant instrument to mar the cohesion of a symphony.
When neurons begin to play nonstop, out of tune, and all at once, because of disease, trauma, tumor, lack of sleep, or even alcohol withdrawal, the cacophonous result can be a seizure. For some people, the result is a tonic-clonic seizure, like the one Stephen witnessed, characterized by loss of consciousness or muscle rigidity and a strange, often synchronized dance of involuntary movements, my terrifying zombie moves. Others may have more subtle seizures, which are characterized by staring episodes, foggy consciousness, and repetitive mouth or body movements. The long-term ramifications of untreated seizures can include cognitive defects and even death. The type and severity of a seizure depend on where the neural dysfunction is focused in the brain. If it is in the visual cortex, the person experiences optical distortions, such as visual hallucinations. If it is in the motor areas of the frontal cortex, the person exhibits strange, zombie-like movements, and so forth. Along with the violent tonic-clonic seizure, it turned out I had also been experiencing complex partial seizures because of overstimulation in my temporal lobes, generally considered to be the most ticklish part of the brain. The temporal lobe houses the ancient structures of the hippocampus and the amygdala, the parts of the brain responsible for emotion and memory. The symptoms from this type of seizure can range from a Christmas morning feeling of euphoria to sexual arousal to religious experiences. Often people report feeling déjà vu and its opposite, something called jamais vu, when everything seems unfamiliar, such as my feeling of alienation in the office bathroom, seeing halos of light or viewing the world as if it is bizarrely out of proportion, known as the Alice in Wonderland effect, which is what was happening while I was on my way to interview John Walsh, and experiencing photophobia, an extreme sensitivity to light, like my visions in Times Square. These are all common symptoms or precedents of temporal lobe seizures. A small subset of those with temporal lobe epilepsy, about 5 to 6%, report an out-of-body experience, a feeling described as being removed from your body and able to look at yourself, usually from above.
There I am on a gurney. There I am, being loaded into the ambulance as Stephen holds my hands. There I am, entering a hospital. Here I am, floating above the scene, looking down. I am calm. There is no fear.
Chapter 9. A Touch of Madness. When I gained consciousness, the first thing I saw was a homeless man vomiting just a few feet away in a brightly lit hospital room. In one corner, another man, bloodied, beaten, and handcuffed to the bed, was flanked by two police officers. Am I dead? Anger at my surroundings welled up inside me. How dare they put me here? I was too incensed to be terrified, and so I lashed out. I hadn't felt like myself for weeks, but the real damage to my personality was only now bubbling to the surface. Looking back at this time, I see that I'd begun to surrender to the disease, allowing all the aspects of my personality that I value, patience, kindness, and courteousness, to evaporate. I was a slave to the machinations of my aberrant brain. We are, in the end, a sum of our parts. And when the body fails, all the virtues we hold dear go with it. I am not dead yet. I am dying because of him, because of that lab technician. I convinced myself that the tech who may have flirted with me when I had my MRI was clearly behind all this.
Get me out of this room now, I commanded.
Stephen held my hand, looking frightened by the imperiousness in my voice.
I will not stay in this room.
I will not die here. I will not die with these freaks. A doctor approached my bedside.
Yes, we will move you right away.
I was triumphant, delighted by my newfound power. People listen when I speak. Instead of worrying that my life was out of control, I began to focus on anything that made me feel strong. A nurse and a male assistant wheeled my bed out of the room and into a nearby private one. As the bed moved, I clutched Stephen's hand. I felt so sorry for him. He didn't know that I was dying. I don't want you to get upset, I said softly, but I'm dying of melanoma. Stephen looked spent.
Stop it, Susanna. Don't say that.
You don't know what's wrong.
I noticed tears welling up in his eyes. He can't handle it.
Suddenly, the outrage returned. I do know what's wrong, I yelled. I'm going to sue him. I'm going to take him for all he's worth. He thinks he can hit on me and just let me die. He can't just do that. No, I'm going to destroy him in court.
Stephen withdrew his hand swiftly as if he'd been burned. Susanna, please stay calm. I don't know what you're talking about.
The MRI guy. He hit on me. He didn't catch the melanoma. I'm suing.
The young resident interrupted me mid-rant.
This is something you might want to look into when you get home. If you need a good dermatologist, I would be happy to recommend one. Unfortunately, there's nothing more we can do here.
The hospital had already conducted a CT scan, a basic neurological exam, and a blood test.
We have to discharge you and advise that you see a neurologist first thing tomorrow.
Discharged? Stephen interjected. You're letting her go? But you don't know what's wrong, and it could happen again. How can you just let her go?
I'm sorry, but seizures are fairly common. Sometimes they just happen and never happen again. But this is an emergency room, and we can't just keep her to see. I'm sorry. My advice is to see a neurologist first thing tomorrow morning.
I'm still suing that guy.
The doctor nodded patiently and departed to address the gunshot wounds and drug overdoses that awaited him.
I have to call your mom, Stephen said.
You don't have to do that, I insisted, my voice mellowing as I returned almost instantly to my old self.
Manic episodes can fade away as quickly as they arise. I don't want her to worry. Mom was a worrier by nature, and I had tried to spare her the full story of what was happening to me so far.
I have to, he insisted, and coaxed her home number out of me.
He stepped into the hallway and waited two interminably long rings before Alan, my stepfather, picked up the phone.
Hello? He said groggily in his thick Bronx accent.
Alan, it's Stephen. I'm at the hospital. Susanna had a seizure, but she's doing fine.
In the background, my mom shouted, Alan, what is it?
She's going to be okay. They're discharging her, Stephen continued.
Despite my mom's rising panic, Alan maintained his composure, telling Stephen to go back home and sleep. They would come in the morning. When he hung up the phone, my mom and Alan looked at each other. It was Friday the 13th. My mom felt the foreboding, and she began to cry uncontrollably, certain that something was seriously wrong. It was the first and last time she would allow herself to completely succumb to her emotions in the frightening months that followed. First thing the next morning, while Alan scouted the street for parking, my mom arrived at my apartment door looking sharp as always. Her frenetic energy, however, was palpable. She was terrified of even hearing about cancer on the radio, and now she had to cope with her own daughter's mysterious seizure. I watched from the bed as she wrung her beautifully shaped hands, the feature I most adored about her, lobbing question after question at Stephen about the night in the hospital.
Did they give any explanation? What kind of doctor saw her? Did they do an MRI?
Alan came around behind her and massaged her earlobe, a habit of his to calm people he loves. She unwound the instant he touched her. Alan is her third husband, after my dad. Her first husband was an architect, and the marriage didn't work for a number of reasons, in part because my mom, very much a feminist of the 1970s, didn't want children. She wanted to focus instead on her career at Manhattan's district attorney's office, where she still worked. When she met my father, she left her first husband, and together they had my brother, James, and me. Despite having had kids together, their relationship was ill-fated from the start. Both were as hot-tempered as they were stubborn, yet they managed to make their marriage last nearly two decades before they divorced. My mom and Alan had met 30 years ago at the district attorney's office, long before she married my dad. Alan had won her over as a friend with his loyalty and devotion. He eventually became her key confidant in and out of the DA's office and through her divorce with my father. Alan's brother was schizophrenic, and as a result, Alan had turned inward, maintaining only a few important friendships and living primarily in his own world. He was animated with his closest loved ones, gesticulating wildly with his hands and laughing a contagious guffaw.
With outsiders, he could be quiet and aloof, to the point of seeming rude. But his warmth and calm, not to mention his experience with mental illness, would prove invaluable over the coming weeks. Before my seizure, he and my mom had developed a theory culled from the few things that they knew about my month of strange behavior. They suspected I was having a nervous breakdown, prompted by stress at work and the responsibilities of living on my own. The seizure didn't fit into that scenario, though, and now they were even more concerned. After some debate, they decided it would be safest for me to come home with them to Summit, New Jersey, where they could look after me. Stephen, my mom, and Alan used various tactics to try to get me out of bed, but I refused to budge. To me, the most important thing was to stay in my own apartment no matter what. Going back to my parents' house would make me feel like a child. As badly as I needed it, help was the last thing I wanted. Somehow, though, their combined forces managed to get me out of my house and into the Subaru. Summit, named one of the best places to live in America by Money magazine, is an affluent suburb 20 miles from Manhattan, a haven for WASPs and Wall Street bankers who congregate at the many country clubs within its 6 square miles. We'd moved there in 1996 from Brooklyn, but even though it had been an ideal place to grow up, our family had never exactly fit in. In a neighborhood of white houses, my mom had chosen to paint our house a lavender gray purple, which prompted one of my 6th grade classmates to comment, "My mom says that you're going to get polka dots, too." Eventually, my mom changed the color to a less outrageous blue-gray. Instead of relaxing into the nostalgia of being back in my childhood home, though, as I settled into the Summit house over the next few days, I began to cling even more vehemently to the Manhattan life I'd left behind. On Sunday afternoon, I became obsessed with filing an overdue article on a fairly simple story about a troupe of dancers that was opening off Broadway who called themselves GIMP, made up of disabled performers. "They're not your typical dancers," I began. Unhappy with the line, I erased it. For the next half hour, I wrote, erased, and rewrote that same sentence until I gave up and began to pace, trying to wrestle myself out of writer's block. I wandered into the family room, where Mom and Alan were watching TV, desperate to tell them about my new trouble with words. But when I got there, I could no longer remember why I'd come. The TV blasted the theme song to their favorite show, the medical drama House. Seconds later, the normally muted green of the couch grew noxiously garish. Then the room seemed to pulsate and breathe, like the office hallway. I heard my mom's voice, shrill and far away. "Susanna! Susanna! Can you hear me?" Next thing I knew, my mom was sitting beside me on the couch, rubbing my feet, which had stiffened up in a painful Charlie horse. I looked up at her helplessly. She said, "I don't know what happened. It was like you were in a trance." My mom and Alan exchanged worried glances and phoned Dr. Bailey to see if they could schedule an emergency appointment. The earliest he could do it, he said, was Monday. I spent the weekend in Summit, ignoring calls from concerned co-workers and friends. I was too embarrassed by my own unexplainable behavior to talk to them, and so consumed by the strange stirring in my mind that I turned away from those closest to me, which normally I would never have done. For some reason, I did pick up the phone once when I saw it was my friend Julie, a post photographer and the most carefree, light-hearted person I know. As soon as we started talking, I began to tell her everything, the seizures, the strange thoughts, the visions. Maybe it was because I knew her mother was a shrink. When I finished, it turned out that she had already spoken to her mother about me. "She thinks it's possible that you're having a manic episode and that maybe you have bipolar disorder. Whatever it is, you should see a psychiatrist," she suggested. Bipolar disorder? Even though it would have sounded grim at any other moment, now the idea was a relief. This made sense. A quick Google search revealed that the National Institute of Mental Health had a whole booklet dedicated to it. A brain disorder that causes unusual shifts in moods, yes. Often develops in a person's late teens or early adult years, yes. An overly joyful state is called a manic episode. An extremely sad or hopeless state is called a depressive episode.
yes, and yes, which equals a mixed state. Another site listed at length the famous people who were suspected to suffer from bipolar disorder. Jim Carrey, Winston Churchill, Mark Twain, Vivian Leigh, Ludwig von Beethoven, Tim Burton. The list kept going and going. I was in good company. No great mind has ever existed without a touch of madness, Aristotle said. I spent the night in a state of ecstasy. I had a name for what plagued me, and those two words which fell off the tongue so sweetly meant everything. I didn't even want to be cured. I now belonged to an exclusive club of creatives. Unconvinced by my self-diagnosis, my mom and Alan drove me back to Dr. Bailey's office that Monday, March 16. The Miro painting no longer seemed as menacing. It matched my mood disorder. Dr. Bailey called us in almost immediately. His demeanor this time seemed far less jolly and grandfatherly, though overall he was pleasant. Again, he went through the basic neurological exam and wrote down normal. Right then, I did feel normal. He jotted down notes on his pad as he asked me questions. Only later would I learn that he was missing details, writing down that I was on a plane when the first seizure occurred. His tone was light when discussing the seizure, but then he slid his glasses down his nose and suddenly sounded very serious.
Is your job very stressful?
Yes, I guess.
Do you feel overwhelmed at times?
Sure.
Tell me honestly, he said, as if preparing himself for me to let him in on a big secret. There are no judgments here. How much alcohol are you drinking a day?
I had to think about it. I hadn't had a drop of booze in the past week, but normally it helped me unwind, so I tended to have a sip of something most nights. To be honest, about 2 glasses of wine a night. I usually split a bottle with my boyfriend, though he tends to drink more than I do. He made a note of this in his chart. I didn't understand that doctors usually doubled, even tripled, such numbers because patients often lie about their vices. Instead of 2 drinks a night, he probably believed the number was closer to 6.
Any drug use?
No, not in years, I said, and quickly added, I did some research on bipolar disorder, and I really think that's what I have.
He smiled. I don't have any experience in this field, but it's a possibility. The receptionist will refer you to a very capable psychiatrist who will have more experience with these types of issues.
Great.
Okay, then. Well, otherwise, everything looks normal to me. I'm going to draw you up a prescription for Keppra, an anti-seizure medication. Take that, and everything should be fine. I'll see you in 2 weeks, he said, and walked me to the waiting area. I'm going to also have a little talk with your mother, if you don't mind.
He waved her into his office. After he had closed the door behind him, he turned to her.
I think this is very simple, plain and simple. She's partying too hard, not sleeping enough, and working too hard. Make sure she doesn't drink and takes the Keppra I prescribed, and everything should be fine.
My mom was filled with immense relief. It was just the answer she wanted to hear. Chapter 10. Mixed Episodes. Alan drove us up to a pre-war brownstone on the Upper East Side, where the psychiatrist, Sarah Levin, lived and worked. My mom and I walked to the entrance and pressed the buzzer. A Carol Kane falsetto trilled through the intercom.
Come right in and sit in the waiting area. I'll be right with you.
With its white walls, magazines, and bookcases filled with all the classics of literature, Dr. Levin's waiting area seemed straight out of a Woody Allen film. I was excited to see the psychiatrist. I wanted her to confirm, once and for all, my bipolar self-diagnosis, but I also considered psychiatric visits entertaining on a certain level. For a period of time after an old breakup, I had gone to 3 separate psychologists, testing them out. The exercise was largely self-indulgent, inspired by watching too many episodes of the HBO show In Treatment. First, I saw the attractive young gay man who acted like my best friend and enabler, then a green and geeky but cheap shrink who took my insurance and immediately asked me about my relationship with my father, then an old curmudgeon who tried to hypnotize me with a plastic wand.
Come on in,
said Dr. Levin, appearing at the door. I smiled. She looked like Carol Kane, too.
She motioned for me to sit in the leather chair.
I hope you don't mind, but I always take pictures of my patients to keep track of everyone, she said, nodding at the Polaroid camera in her hands.
I posed, not sure if I should smile or remain serious. I remembered what my friend Zach from work had once told me years before when I first went on live television during the Michael Devlin affair. Smile with your eyes. So that's what I tried to do.
So, tell me a bit about why you're here, she asked, cleaning her glasses.
I'm bipolar.
I'm sorry, she said. Say that again.
I'm bipolar. She nodded, as if agreeing with me.
Are you on any medication for that?
No, I haven't been officially diagnosed, but I know. I mean, I know myself better than anyone, right? So I should know if I have it, and I know that I do. I rambled on, the illness imposing itself on my speech patterns. She nodded again.
Tell me why you think you're bipolar.
As I made my case through my strange, jumpy logic, she jotted down her impressions on 2 pages of wide-ruled paper. Said she had bipolar disorder. Hard to conclude, she wrote. Everything is very vivid. Started in last few days. Can't concentrate. Easily distracted. Total insomnia, but not tired, not eating. Has grand ideas. No hallucinations. No paranoid delusions. Always impulsive. Dr. Levin asked if I had any history of feeling this way, and wrote, She's had hypomanic attacks her whole life, always has high energy, but has negative thoughts. She was never suicidal. Dr. Levin's opinion was that I was experiencing a mixed episode, meaning both manic and depressive elements typical of bipolar disorder. She moved several large books on her desk around until she found her script pad and scrawled out a prescription for Zyprexa, an antipsychotic prescribed to treat mood and thought disorders. While I was in the office with Dr. Levin, my mother called my younger brother, a freshman at the University of Pittsburgh. Even though James was only 19, he already had a wise, old soul quality that I've always found comforting. Susanna had a seizure, she told James, trying to control the wavering of her voice. James was stunned. The neurologist is saying she drank too much. Do you think Susanna is an alcoholic? My mom asked him. James was adamant. No way is Susanna an alcoholic. Well, Susanna's insisting that she's manic depressive. Do you think that's a possibility? James thought on this for a moment. No, not in the least. That's just not Susanna. Sure, she can be excitable and temperamental, but she's not depressive. She's tough, Mom. We all know that. She deals with a lot of stress, but she handles it better than anyone I know. Bipolar doesn't make any sense to me.
Me neither, my mom said. Me neither.
Chapter 11. Keppra. Later the next night, I had an epiphany. Forget bipolar disorder. It was the anti-seizure medication Keppra. The Keppra must be causing my insomnia, forgetfulness, anxiety, hostility, moodiness, numbness, loss of appetite. It didn't matter that I had been on the drug for only 24 hours. It was all the Keppra. An internet search proved it. These were all side effects of that toxic drug. My mother pleaded with me to take it anyway. Do it for me, she begged. Just please take the pill. So I did. Even during this time when I hardly recognize myself, there are still shadows of the real Susanna, a person who cares what her family and friends think, who doesn't want to cause them pain. Looking back, I think that's why, despite the battles, I often caved at my family's insistences. That night, as the alarm clock by my bed struck midnight, I lifted my head with a start. The damn pills! They're taking over my body! I'm going crazy! The Keppra! I need it out of my system! Throw it up! Get it out! A voice chanted. I kicked off my sheets and jumped out of bed. Keppra! Keppra! I went to the hallway bathroom, ran the water, got on my knees, and knelt over the toilet bowl. I jammed my fingers down my throat, wiggling them around until I dry heaved. I wiggled more, thin white liquid. Nothing solid came up because I hadn't eaten in longer than I could remember. Damn Keppra! I flushed the toilet, turned off the water, and paced.
The next thing I knew, I was upstairs on the third floor where my mom and Alan slept. They'd moved up there when James and I were teenagers because it worried them too much to hear us coming and going at night. Now I stood over my mom's bed and watched her sleep. The half moon shone down on her. She looked so helpless, like a newborn baby. Swelling with tenderness, I leaned over and stroked her hair, startling her awake.
"Oh, my! Susanna, are you okay?"
"I can't sleep." She rearranged her mussed-up, cropped hair and yawned.
"Let's go downstairs,"
she whispered, taking my hand and leading me back into my bedroom. She lay down beside me, brushing out my tangled hair with her beautiful hands for over an hour until she fell back asleep. I listened to her breathing, soft and low, in and out, and tried to replicate it, but I didn't sleep. The next day, on March 18, 2009, at 2:50 p.m., I wrote the first in a series of random Word documents that would become a kind of temporary diary over this period. The documents reveal my scattered and increasingly erratic thought processes. Basically, I'm bipolar, and that's what makes me me. I just have to get control of my life. I love working. I love it. I have to break up with Stephen. I can read people really well, but I'm too jumbly. I let work take way too much out of my life. During a conversation earlier that day when we discussed my future, I told my father that I wanted to go back to school, specifically to the London School of Economics, even though I had no history of studying business. Wisely, gently, my father suggested that I write down all my racing thoughts. So that's what I did for the next few days. My father suggested writing in a journal, which is definitely helping me. He told me to get a puzzle, and that was smart because he too thinks in puzzles, the way things fit together. Some of the statements are incoherent messes, but others are strangely illuminating, providing deep access to areas of my life that I'd never before examined. I wrote about my passion for journalism. Angela sees something in me because she knows how hard it is to be good at this job, but that's journalism. It's a hard job. And maybe it's not for me. I have a very powerful gut. And I went on about my need for structure in a life that was quickly falling to pieces. Routine is important to me, as is discipline. Without it, I tend to go a little bit haywire. As I wrote these lines and others, I felt that I was piecing together, word by word, what was wrong with me. But my thoughts were tangled in my mind like necklaces knotted together in a jewelry box. Just when I thought I had untwisted one, I would realize it was connected to a rat's nest of others. Now, years later, these Word documents haunt me more than any unreliable memory. Maybe it's true what Thomas More said. It is only through mystery and madness that the soul is revealed. That night, I walked into the family room and announced to my mom and Alan, "I've got it figured out. It's Stephen. It's too much pressure. It's too much. I'm too young." My mom and Alan nodded empathetically. I left the room, but then, a few feet outside the doorway, another solution emerged. I retraced my steps. "Actually, it's the post. I'm unhappy there, and it's making me crazy. I need to go back to school." They nodded again. I left and then turned straight around again. "No, it's my lifestyle. It's New York City. It's too much for me. I should move back to St. Louis or Vermont or someplace quiet. New York isn't for me." By now they were staring at me, concern creasing their faces, but still they continued to nod accommodatingly. I left once more, cantering from the family room to the kitchen and then back. This time I had it. This time I had figured it out. This time it all made sense. The oriental rug scraped my cheek, oval droplets of blood marring the pattern. My mom's shrill screams. I had collapsed on the floor, bitten my tongue, and was convulsing like a fish out of water, my body dancing in jerking motions. Alan ran over and put his finger in my mouth, but in a spasm I bit down hard on it, adding his blood to my own. I came to, minutes later, to the sound of my mother on the phone with Dr. Bailey, frantic for some kind of answer. He insisted that I keep taking the medication and come in for an electroencephalogram, EEG, on Saturday to test the electrical activity of my brain. 2 days later, that Friday, Stephen came to Summit to visit and suggested that we get out of the house and grab some dinner. He had been debriefed by my family about my deteriorating behavior and was on high alert, but he knew that it was important for me to leave the house. Because of the threat of seizures, I could not drive a car and maintain some semblance of an adult life. We headed to an Irish pub in Maplewood, New Jersey, where I had never been before. The bar was crowded with families and teenagers. People hovered around the hostess's desk, jockeying for reservations. I knew immediately that there were too many people. They all stared at me. They whispered to each other, "Susanna, Susanna." I could hear it. My breath got shallower, and I began to sweat. "Susanna? Susanna?" Stephen repeated. "She said it's a 40-minute wait. Do you want to wait or go?" He gestured to the hostess, who did in fact look at me curiously. The old man, who seemed to be wearing a toupee, jeered at me. The hostess raised her eyebrows. Stephen grabbed my hand and walked me out of the restaurant into the freedom of the frigid air. Now I could breathe again. Stephen drove me to nearby Madison, to a dingy bar called Poor Herbie's, where there was no wait. The waitress, a woman in her mid-60s with frizzy, bleached blonde hair and gray roots, stood at the table with her left hand on her hip, waiting for our orders. I just stared at the menu. "She'll take the chicken sandwich," Stephen said, after it was clear I was incapable of making such a momentous decision. "And I'll have the Reuben." When the food came, I could focus only on the greasy French dressing congealing on Stephen's corned beef sandwich. I looked down at my own sandwich despairingly. Nothing could convince me to put it to my lips. "It's too grisly," I told Stephen.
"But you didn't try it. If you don't eat this, there's nothing but gefilte fish and chicken livers at home," he joked, trying to lighten the mood by pointing out Alan's strange eating habits.
Stephen finished his Reuben, but I left the chicken sandwich untouched. As we walked to the car, two conflicting urges struck me. I needed either to break up with Stephen here and now or profess my love to him for the first time. It could go either way. Both impulses were equally intense.
"Stephen, I really need to talk to you."
He looked at me oddly. I stammered, growing red before conjuring up the courage to speak, although I still didn't know what was going to come out of my mouth. He, too, was half expecting me to break up with him at that moment.
I really love you. I don't know. I love you."
Tenderly, he grasped my hands in his own.
"I love you, too. You just have to relax."
It was not how either of us had hoped this exchange would happen. It was not the kind of memory you recalled to your grandchildren, but there it was. We were in love. Later that night, Stephen noticed that I had begun to steadily smack my lips together as if I was sucking on a candy. I licked my lips so often that my mom started to apply globs of Vaseline to keep them from cracking open and bleeding. Sometimes I would trail off mid-sentence, staring off into space for several minutes before continuing my conversation. During these moments, the paranoid aggression receded into a childlike state. These times were the most unnerving for everyone, since I'd been pig-headedly self-sufficient even as a toddler. We didn't know it then, but these, too, were complex partials, the more subtle types of seizures that create those repetitive mouth movements and that foggy consciousness. I was getting worse by the day, by the hour even, but no one knew what to do. At 3:38 a.m. on March 21, as Stephen snored away upstairs, I wrote again in my computer diary.
"Okay, there's no place to start, but you have to, okay? And don't be all, wow, I didn't spell check this."
I had the urge to baby Stephen instead of allowing him to baby me. I've been letting my parents baby me for too long. "You have a mothering instinct. You held him in your arms. You felt you have untangled your mind when you were around him. You found your phone and remembered. Talking to my father makes me feel more with it. My mom babies me way too much because she blames herself for the way I am. But she shouldn't. She's been a great mother, and she should know that. Who gives a shit what anyone thinks about me? I'm going to..."
"Stephen, he keeps you sane. He's also very smart.
Don't let how humble he is fool you, okay? You got this crossroads because of him, and you should be forever grateful for that, so be kind to him. Reading these entries now is like peering into a stranger's stream of consciousness. I don't recognize the person on the other end of the screen as me. Though she urgently attempts to communicate some deep, dark part of herself in her writing, she remains incomprehensible, even to myself. Chapter 12. The Ruse. On Saturday morning, my mom tried to get me to return to Dr. Bailey's for the EEG. I had had two identifiable seizures and had developed an increasing number of worrying symptoms in the past week alone, and my family needed answers. "Absolutely not," I grumbled, stamping my feet like a 2-year-old. "I'm fine. I don't need this." Alan walked outside to start the car as Stephen and my mother pleaded with me. "Nope. Not going. Nope," I replied. "We have to go. Please, just come," my mom said. "Let me talk to her for a second," Stephen said to my mom, leading me outside. "Your mom is only trying to help you, and you're making her very upset. Will you please just come?" I thought this over for a moment. I loved my mom. Fine. Yes, I would go. Then a moment later, "No, I couldn't possibly leave." After a half hour more of persuading, I finally got into the back seat of the car beside Stephen. As we drove out of our driveway and onto the street, Alan began to speak. I could hear him distinctly, though he wasn't moving his lips.
"You're a slut. I think Stephen should know."
My whole body shook with anger, and I leaned threateningly toward the driver's seat.
"What did you say?"
"Nothing," Alan said, sounding both surprised and exhausted. That was the last straw. Swiftly, I unbuckled my seatbelt, yanked open the car door, and prepared to jump out of the car head first. Stephen grabbed the back of my shirt in mid-leap, saving me from launching myself out of the vehicle. Alan slammed on the brakes.
"Susanna, what the hell are you doing?"
my mom screamed. "Susanna," Stephen said in a level tone, a timbre I had never before heard from him. "That is not okay." Obedient again, I closed the door and crossed my arms. But hearing the click of the child's lock sent me into panic mode again. I flung myself against the locked door and screamed,
"Let me out! Let me out!"
over and over until I was too exhausted to yell anymore, then rested my head against Stephen's shoulder and momentarily nodded off. When I opened my eyes again, we had exited the Holland Tunnel and were entering Chinatown, with its sidewalk fish, swarms of tourists, and fake designer bag salesmen. The whole sordid scene disgusted me.
"I want coffee. Get me coffee. Now. I'm hungry. Feed me," I demanded insufferably.
"Can't you wait until we get uptown?" my mom asked.
"No. Now."
It suddenly seemed like the most important thing in the world. Alan took a sharp turn, almost hitting a parked car, and took West Broadway to the Square Diner, one of the last authentic train car diners in New York City. Alan couldn't figure out how to unlock the child's lock, so I climbed over Stephen to get out of his door, hoping to disappear before any of them could catch up. Stephen suspected as much and followed me. Since I couldn't get away, I sauntered into the diner in search of coffee and an egg sandwich. It was Sunday morning, so the line to eat was long, but I wouldn't wait. I barbarously nudged an elderly lady out of my way, and spotting an open booth, sat down. I shouted obnoxiously to no one in particular, "I want coffee!" Stephen took the seat opposite mine.
"We can't stay. Can't you just get it to go?"
Ignoring him, I snapped my fingers, and the waitress arrived.
"A coffee and egg sandwich."
"To go," Stephen added. He was mortified, rightly, by my behavior. I could be willful, but he had never seen me be rude. Luckily, the man behind the counter, who had been listening in on the exchange, called out,
"I've got it."
He turned his back to us and cooked the eggs. A minute later, he delivered a steaming cup of coffee and a cheese-covered egg sandwich in a brown paper bag. I swaggered out of the diner. The paper coffee cup was so hot that it burned my skin, but I didn't care. I made things happen. I was powerful.
When I snapped my fingers, people jumped. If I couldn't understand what was making me feel this way, at least I could control the people around me. I threw the egg sandwich, uneaten, on the car floor.
I thought you were hungry, Stephen said.
I'm not anymore.
Mom and Alan exchanged glances in the front seat. The traffic was light heading uptown, so we got to Dr. Bailey's quickly. When I walked into the office, something felt different about the place. Odd, alien. I felt like Gonzo walking into the casino after he had dropped mescaline in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Nothing was as it seemed, and everything dripped with apocalyptic meaning. The other waiting patients were caricatures, subhuman. The glass window that separated the receptionist from us seemed utterly barbaric. The Miro was smiling down at me again with that twisted, unnatural grin. We waited. It could have been minutes or several hours. I have no idea. Time didn't exist here. Eventually, a middle-aged female technician called me into an examination room, wheeling in a cart behind her. She dug out a box full of electrodes and pasted all 21 of them, one by one, onto my scalp, first rubbing the dry skin and then fixing them to my head with some kind of glue. She turned off the lights. "Relax," she said, "and keep your eyes closed until I tell you to open them. Breathe deeply in and out. One complete breath for every 2 seconds." She counted for me. 1, 2, exhale. 1, 2, exhale. 1, 2, exhale. And then faster. 1, exhale. 1, exhale. 1, exhale. It went on forever. My face flushed and I started to get dizzy and lightheaded. I heard her fiddling around with something across the room, so I opened my eyes enough to see her handling a small flashlight. "Open your eyes and look directly into the light," she said. It pulsated like a strobe, but with no apparent rhythm to its pattern. When she turned on the light to remove the electrodes, she began to speak to me.
"So, are you a student?"
"No."
"What do you do?"
"I'm a reporter. I write for a newspaper."
"Stressful, huh?"
"Sure, I guess."
"There's nothing wrong with you," she said, gathering the electrodes back into the box. "I've seen this dozens of times, mostly with bankers and Wall Street guys who come in here all stressed out. There's nothing wrong with them. It's all in their heads."
"It's all in my head." When she closed the door behind her, I smiled. That smile turned into a laugh, a belly laugh dripping with bitterness and resentment. It all made sense. This was all a ruse, set up to punish me for my bad behavior and tell me that I'm suddenly cured. Why would they try to trick me? Why would they arrange something this elaborate? She wasn't a nurse. She was a hired actor.
My mother was the only person left in the waiting room. Alan had left to get the car, and Stephen, overwhelmed by my harrowing behavior on the ride in, had called his mom for consolation and advice. I gave my mom a wide, toothy smile.
"What's so funny?"
"Oh, you thought I wouldn't figure it out. Where's the mastermind?"
"What are you talking about?"
"You and Alan set this all up. You hired that woman. You hired everyone here. You told her what to say. You wanted to punish me. Well, it didn't work. I'm too smart for your tricks."
My mom's mouth fell open in horror, but my paranoia read it as nothing more than mock surprise.
Chapter 13. Buddha. The whole time I'd been in Summit, I had been begging to return to my Manhattan apartment. I felt constantly under surveillance by my family. So, on Sunday, the day after my EEG, my mom, exhausted by the week of sleepless nights and constant monitoring, agreed, against her better judgment, to let me revisit my apartment under one condition: I spend the night at my father's house. Though my behavior was worsening day by day, it was still difficult for her to reconcile the old image that she had of her daughter as trustworthy, hard-working, and independent with the new, unpredictable, and dangerous one. I quickly consented to spend the night with my father. I would have said anything to get back to my own studio. I felt calmer as soon as we arrived in Hell's Kitchen, being so close to freedom again. As soon as we saw my father and Giselle waiting outside on the front stoop of my building, I bounded out of the car. My mom and Alan didn't follow, but they did wait until the three of us were safely inside before driving away. I was delighted to be back in my safe haven. Here was my cat, Dusty, a blue-haired stray who'd been tended by my friend Zach during my week-long absence. I was even glad to see the unwashed clothes and black plastic bags filled with books and debris, and the garbage overflowing with stale food. Home sweet home.
"What's that smell?" my father asked.
I hadn't cleaned my apartment since the last time he came, and it had only gotten worse. Some of the leftover shrimp from the meal Stephen had cooked had spoiled in the garbage. Without hesitating, my father and Giselle began cleaning. They scrubbed the floors and disinfected every inch of that small apartment, but I didn't even offer to help. I just walked around them, watching them clean and pretending to gather my things.
"I'm so messy," I said, stroking my cat triumphantly. "Messy, messy, messy."
After they finished, my father motioned for me to follow him out of the apartment.
"Nah," I said nonchalantly. "I think I'm just going to stay here."
"Absolutely not."
"How about I meet you in Brooklyn after I get a few things together?"
"Absolutely not."
"I will not leave."
Dad and Giselle exchanged knowing glances like they had prepared for such an outburst. Presumably, Mom had warned them about me. Giselle rounded up the cleaning supplies and headed downstairs to get away from the unfolding unpleasantness. "Come on, Susanna. We'll grab some coffee. I'll cook you dinner. It will be nice and calm. Just come over."
"No!"
"Please, will you do this for me?" he asked. It took half an hour, but I finally agreed, grabbing a handful of underwear and a few other clean clothes. The illness seemed to wane momentarily, allowing the old, reasonable Susanna to return briefly. The three of us chatted a little as we walked toward the subway on 42nd Street. But the calm didn't last long. Paranoia took hold as I was crossing 9th Avenue. "My father has taken my keys. I have no way to get back to my apartment. I am his prisoner." "No, no, no!" I shouted in the middle of the street, stopping just as the lights turned green. "I'm not going. I want to go home." I felt my dad's tight grip on my shoulders as he pushed me out of the way of the oncoming traffic. I continued to scream as he hailed a cab. When the cab pulled up, he pushed me inside, and Giselle entered on the other side, so I was wedged between them. They were determined to prevent another escape attempt.
"They're kidnapping me! Call the police! Call the police! They're taking me against my will!"
I screamed at the Middle Eastern cab driver. He looked back in his rearview mirror but did not drive.
"Let me go! I'm calling the cops!"
"Get out! Leave car, now!" the driver said.
My father gripped the bulletproof partition and said through gritted teeth,
"You better fucking drive. Don't you dare stop."
I can't imagine what the driver thought, because it must have looked tremendously suspicious, but he obliged. Soon he started to speed, darting in and out of traffic on the Brooklyn Bridge.
"I'm calling the police when I get out. You'll see. You'll be arrested for kidnapping," I shouted at my dad.
The driver glanced at us warily in the mirror.
"You do that," my dad said nastily.
Giselle remained quiet and looked out the window as if trying to block out the scene. Then my father softened his voice.
"Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this to me?"
Honestly, I had no idea, but I was convinced I wasn't safe in his care. By the time we arrived at their brownstone in Brooklyn Heights, I was too exhausted to fight anymore. I had nothing left, which wasn't surprising since I hadn't eaten or slept in a week. When we got inside, Giselle and my father headed to the kitchen. They began to cook my favorite meal, penne arrabbiata, as I sat on the couch in the living room, staring dazedly at my father's busts of Abraham Lincoln and George Washington. My father's house is an ode to American wars, filled with antiques and memorabilia spanning the Revolutionary War to World War II. He even calls one anteroom that separates the den from the living room the war room. There are muskets from the Civil War, M1 Garands that were used from World War I to Vietnam,
Colt revolvers from the 1800s, a Revolutionary War sword, and a soldier's hat from the same era. Before the divorce, he'd kept most of these possessions in our Summit House's family room, which scared off many boyfriends during my high school years. They set the long harvest table and brought over a heaping, pulsating dish of reds, greens, and yellows, tomato, basil, cheese, and penne in a blue Le Creuset pot. Pancetta glistened unnaturally in the blood-red tomato sauce. I stifled the urge to vomit or throw the penne against the wall and just watched as my dad and Giselle ate the pasta in silence. After dinner, I went into the kitchen to get some water. Giselle was cleaning. She walked past me to put the dishes in the sink, and as she moved, I heard her say, "You're a spoiled brat." The words hung in the air around me like pockets of smoke. I didn't see her mouth move. "What did you say to me?" "Nothing," she said, looking surprised. My father waited for me in his den in a patterned antique rocking chair that had belonged to his aunt. I opted for silence about what I believed Giselle had called me. "Stay here with me tonight," I asked him instead, sitting on the leather couch by his side. The TV was off, so we made small talk, our conversation punctuated by uneasy blocks of silence. "I'm scared of being alone." "Of course," he said. Then, "Leave me alone! Get out of the room!" And then, all over again, "I'm sorry. Will you please stay?" This went on for several hours, moving from hysterics to accusations and then back to apologies. Beyond that, I can't remember much at all of that night, which might be my body's way of trying to preserve some self-respect. No one wants to think of herself as a monster. My father doesn't remember what happened either, although it's more likely that he has consciously chosen to forget. I do know that I said something terrible to him, something so awful that it made my father cry, the first time I had ever seen him cry in my life. But instead of generating sympathy, this just added to my twisted need for power. I ordered him to leave the room and go back upstairs to his bedroom. A few moments later, a sickening blast and boom came from upstairs. Pound, pound, pound. I chose to ignore it. I walked into his war room, picked up the Revolutionary War sword, removed it from its sheath, entranced by the blade, and then returned it. Then I heard Giselle's voice. She was pleading with my father. "Please, don't hurt me," she begged. "Don't hurt me because of her." Again, the imaginary pound, pound, pound. I returned to the den and sat back down on the leather couch. A painting depicting the drafting of the Declaration of Independence bustled with activity. Over the fireplace, a large oil painting of a railroad scene came to life, the train emitting tufts of coal-covered smog. The bust of Lincoln seemed to follow me with its sunken eyes. The dollhouse that my father made for me when I was a child was haunted. Pound, pound, pound. It was the sound of fists hitting a hard object, like a skull. I could see it all clearly. He was beating her because he was upset with me. Pound, pound, pound. I needed to find an exit. There had to be some way out. I clawed at the apartment door frantically, but found it locked from the outside. Is he keeping me in here to kill me next? I hurled myself against the door, ignoring the shooting pains in my right shoulder. I must get out. Let me out. Let me out! Let me out! Someone help me! I screamed, banging my fists against the door. I heard my father's heavy footsteps on the stairs above me. I ran. Where? Bathroom. I locked the door behind me and tried to move the heavy 8-foot armoire against the door to barricade myself in. The window! It overlooked a 2-story drop. I figured I could survive the fall. Susanna, are you okay? Please, open the door. Yes, I could probably have made the jump, but then I caught sight of a small Buddha that Giselle kept on the bathroom counter. It smiled at me. I smiled back. Everything would be all right.